This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. Welcome to the show. 6 o'clock, Monday morning. It's the 20th of March. I'm Melissa Idris. With me this morning, Julian Ng. Good morning, Jules.
Good morning.
Did you have a good weekend?
Not bad. Had a good rest.
Yeah, just stay around at home, just chilling out.
Just chilling out. And chill. Doing nothing. Absolutely nothing.
I actually went down to Singapore for a day trip to check out Beauty and the Beast. I joined the crew of At the Movies, who did a podcast there. And I thought, well, I'm never going to get to watch the movie here, so I might as well go. A big Beauty and the Beast fan, of course.
I hear that it opened to a record-breaking box office in the US.
Well, same with Disney, isn't it? I mean, anything Disney is like the Midas touch, of course. They did a good job, but I still have a soft place in my heart for the animated version. I have to say, I don't know what all the fuss is about with that exclusively gay moment that caused all the kerfuffle with the censorship here in Malaysia. After the movie, I went, huh, what moment? Where was it? Did I miss it?
She had come out with a very good feeling, like a feel-good feeling.
Yeah, well, you know, Disney cartoons, of course. I got the same goosebumps that I got watching the animated version for the first time. So there you go. Quite interesting. I think a whole new generation of you know, youngins will appreciate this. If you think about it, the original came out in 1991, so many years ago.
More than two decades ago.
Yeah, so you've got a whole generation who probably didn't grow up on it the way I did. So I'm glad I went to do that. But, you know, that was like the whole weekend lost because the Saturday was spent traveling.
How was it in Singapore?
It was Singapore, you know. I mean, as much as I love it, I was happy to be back. I think the causeway over the weekend gets really, the second link or whenever you travel to Singapore, you just see how much movement of people, you know, coming in and out of the city, Johor Bahru and Singaporeans it's really quite remarkable and how busy that bridge gets.
I think a lot of people commute from JB to Singapore.
Spend the weekend there.
And then the other way around as well. Singaporeans going into Malaysia over the weekend as well.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Well, tell us how your weekend was. We'd love to hear from you. You can tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp 016-201-9000. Always happy to hear how your weekend went. But stay with us for the next 4 hours because we've got a great show lined up for you today. Christine Ng, the CEO of PeopleLender, will be on The Breakfast Grill. Tan Chung Han will be speaking to her. And PeopleLender is one of the 6 peer-to-peer lending platforms that was approved by Securities Commission recently. So they operate the crowdfunding site called Fundstastic. And what they're trying to do is to fulfill this gap that they see, this financing gap within the industry where startups and entrepreneurs are unable to secure the financing they need simply because perhaps it's risky or they don't have the track record. So they're going through crowdfunding.
Well, this is a very specific area of crowdfunding called peer-to-peer lending. And it's different from other crowdfunding sites you can go in there and like how you would deposit into a fixed deposit account, which would give you about 3-odd%. Over here, when you go into peer-to-peer lending, you get a much, much higher interest rates. I think the SE caps it at about 18% per annum.
Okay.
That you can't go above that, which is a pity to me because essentially it's not really market-driven if you cap prices, which interest rates are essentially the pricing of loan. If you want something that is truly P2P and truly based on demand and supply, you would ask for a free rein in what you can charge. But I think this is just the starting point of P2P lending in Malaysia. Perhaps it would come in different iterations going forward.
Yeah, so I think it's still in its infancy. But, we're seeing some traction here. It's been about almost coming up to almost a year since the SE approved the 6 crowd lending platforms. But I'm curious to know more about the credit risks involved with P2P lending, as well as how they think the regulators are kind of doing or guiding this nascent industry. At the moment, there's this fine balance between providing regulation and providing some safeguards for investors, at the same time encouraging these crowdfunders to grow, to be allowed to innovate and to grow.
Yeah, I think the people like SE and Bhavnagar have got to keep up with the times, and technology is having such a profound impact on our lives. People are beginning to take things into their own hands in the form of disruption, and the finance sector can't be left behind. And this is where SE comes in and encourage people. I think this is going to be a new asset class where people can go in there and actively seek higher returns for their investments. But there are risks as well. You got to diversify. You know, you got to lend to not just one person at 15% interest rates per annum. You have to diversify your portfolio and lend to, for example, 50 different people just in order to make sure that you don't put all your eggs into one basket.
Yeah, for me, the most famous kind of crowdfunding platform I can think of is Lending Club, and recently they haven't been doing too well. But let's find out. I mean, what the situation is like here in Malaysia. Lending Club is, I think, based in New York. There was recent an IPO in New York a couple of years ago. So let's find out more with Christine Ng as she joins us on The Breakfast Grill at 8 o'clock today. But after the grill on current affairs, we continue our analysis on the North Korean leadership dynasty. Today on the show, we are going to delve into the country's political structure to understand the motives behind Kim Jong-un's actions. So trying to get into the psyche of the North Korean leader, we spoke to Professor Aidan Foster Carter, Senior Research Fellow in Sociology and Modern Korea at the University of Leeds.
He's not been anywhere. That must be unique. You're a head of state. You've been in power for 6 years. You have not left the country once. You've not met any other foreign head of state ever. Kim Jong-un had to prove himself in North Korea. So I think his own priorities were first and foremost internal. He was very young, very inexperienced. His father had a 20-year apprenticeship. Kim Jong-un was pitched into it. And he's proved much better at it than many people thought, in the sense that he's still there, and I think he's pretty evidently in charge. And I think in that system where the ultimate virtue is loyalty, then he has had to show himself to be a worthy successor to his father and grandfather. How do you do that? Well, more missiles, more nuclear tests. So North Korea is a power in the world. I think it's very unclear what his foreign policy goal is. He does stuff regardless of the consequences.
That was Professor Aidan Foster Carter from the University of Leeds. That's a really good point. If you think about, a leader of a country who essentially hasn't left the borders of his own nation, what kind of worldview that must be.
And world peace teeters on the inexperience of this greenhorn who has come to power, ruling over this rogue nation. That's really scary.
Yeah, and as you heard Professor Foster Carter mention just now in the clip, it really is about, showing power with nuclear missile tests and this nuclear program that North Korea has. In fact, over the weekend, North Korea conducted a ground test of a new type of high-thrust rocket engine that Kim Jong-un is calling a revolutionary breakthrough for the country's space program. He said, soon the whole world will witness what eventful significance the great victory won today carries, and that the test marks what will be known as the March 18 revolution in the development of the country's rocket industry. Apparently, Jules, it was done. So this nuclear test was apparently timed for U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's visit. So he's in Beijing at the moment, visiting with Xi Jinping. And since the U.S. is next door, North Korea thought, well, I might as well show my power. Yeah, there you go.
You know, Kim Jong-un is a millennial. He's just 33 years old. Imagine.
Is he only 33?
Yes, he's 33. And imagine a millennial running a country with access to nuclear bombs.
Okay, there you go. That's a scary thought.
Made your day.
There you go. Okay, well, so one of the latest news I saw with regards to the King Jong-nam Association, because, most of the media here have been fixated on that, Malaysian police are apparently expected to make a few more arrests, including an important person with connection to the murder of King Jong-nam. But they declined to elaborate on who this important person is. So I wonder such a teaser. What do they mean by this important person is going to be arrested? I'm so curious. We'll have to keep an eye on this. I mean, they're bound to make an announcement sometime soon. But coming back to the program on the show today at 9:30, Joyce Goh of The Edge Media will be joining us for Pressing Matters. That's the show where we speak to members of the press to go beyond the headlines of the day. And the cover story for the latest issue of The Edge Weekly poses the question, is the golden era of banking over? Because as Joyce argues in her article, banks today have their hands full trying to juggle narrow margins, tough capital requirements, rising costs and tech disruptions. So earnings may be on the rise, but returns on equity are under pressure. She's worried about how the banking sector is faring. So she spoke to a few bankers, top bankers in town, to see how they're dealing with this new normal.
I think technology is coming into every part of our lives, and the banking sector has been for a while been hearing about fintechs, and now they have regtech as well, which is how these technological companies can help regulators ease the process of, you know, fulfilling regulation. And the banks, the Bank Negara Governor Tan Sri Muhammad Ibrahim said that fintech can sort of, he's not a Tan Sri, right? He's a Dato, right? Banks can actually have about 30 to 40% of their profits impacted by fintech. So I think the banks are sitting up and they're concerned about this. It's like a pain on their side, but they have enough capital to play that game as well, to play the fintech game as well. So it's going to be this very interesting interaction between the old guard of the banking sector and the new era of fintechs.
You are right. It is Datuk Muhammad Ibrahim, not Tan Sri. So you just upgraded him, but that's okay.
I know.
That's interesting. I think we want to take a look at how fintech is really disrupting the banking sector. But some banks are saying, well, you know, it's more of an ecosystem, so we're collaborating with fintech. I wonder whether this is just a matter of time. But, you know, this is a really great cover story, so we're going to be speaking to Joyce on Pressing Matters this morning. So let's find out more. 9:30. If you missed that, you can download the podcast on our website or check it out on our brand new BFM app. Very quickly, Jules, let's take a look at some of the big stories over the weekend. Now, the G20 meeting was wrapped up over the weekend. You had finance ministers and central bank governors from the G20 group of economies. That's US, China, Mexico, and everywhere from Germany and India. And they all met up in Germany. And it was the first G20 meeting with the Trump administration. What was really interesting was the fact that in this, the formal statement that the meeting often releases after the it concludes, they omitted a line that was in the last statement. So they said that they removed the line that said we will resist all forms of protectionism. So it seems like the G20 has dropped a long-standing public endorsement of free trade. No longer are they pledging to fight protectionism.
There's no doubt under the pressure of the United States. We can see all these invisible hand at work. I don't know. I think it really we are retrograding towards the progress that we've made over the last few decades when we came to the negotiating table asking for a freer world in trade, and now it's going backwards. It'd be interesting to see how we would deal with this, how the rest of the world would deal with this. I mean, I just heard that inflation numbers for Malaysia, based on a survey, analysts are expecting about 4%, and that's really insane.
Yes,
because it would have a profound impact on our lives.
But the jump would have been so steep, right? I think it was at 3%.
So it's inflation, right? Whether it's from imported inflation, whether the ringgit is weak, and now the question was whether protectionism would push up this inflation number as well.
Well, yesterday we also heard news that rock and roll legend Chuck Berry had died at the age of 90. Now, he is seen as one of the fathers of rock and roll. He influenced a generation of succeeding musicians, most notably the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and also the Beach Boys. So to celebrate his amazing 7-decade career, here's one of Chuck Berry's most famous tunes, John B. Good, right here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Animal Nitrate by Suede. Hello and good morning. It's 6:23. You're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, and Julian Ng. Jules Roland Tan just tweeted us at BFM Radio. He said he's missed us for a whole week. He's just gotten back from Osaka and Kyoto yesterday, as we were just asking earlier for everyone to tweet in and how their weekend went. So Roland said that he loved Japan but missed his prawn mee back home. I hear you, Roland. Miss Braun, me too. But Japan's
I'm
exciting.
So flattered that we can be equivalents to Osaka and Kyoto. I mean, those are really beautiful places.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks for tweeting in. Yeah, tell us how your weekend went at BFM Radio is our Twitter handle, or WhatsApp us at 016-201-9000. Always good to hear from you. But as mentioned a little earlier today on The Breakfast Grill, we're going to be speaking to a person-to-person lender, P2P lender, which is equivalent to kind of bank lending, right, Jules? But on a related note, let's take a look at something called crowdfunding and how it could reshape the way we give to charity. I'm going to cite an example here. Last September, there was this guy who had bought some food from this old man. It was like a 90-year-old man called Fendicio, who owns and operates a food streetcart. And he clearly looked far too old to be working. So the customer had posted a picture of Fendicio on this crowdfunding site called GoFundMe and had asked people to pitch in for a vacation for Fendicio, saying that, you know, the campaign was called Relief for Fendicio. And that campaign had essentially gone viral overnight. It was an instant success. And it's been cited as some sort of a digital parable. The CEO of GoFundMe, Rob Solomon, often uses this example to illustrate the power of social fundraising. They had initially targeted to raise $3,000 for Fendicio, but they ended up raising $300,000.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so GoFundMe is saying that with how much it's projecting to raise in transactions over the next decade, this is going to change the way people give to charity. No longer will you be seeing charitable contributions through the traditional methods, but it's through crowdfunding, through platforms like GoFundMe.
I think this is really very disruptive for charitable contributions because the new ways of doing it, the technology that's being used, will make donations very efficient. When you pass money from the giver to the needy, usually you go through this organization, which would have their distribution methods, and you've got to pay salaries to...
Yes, overheads.
You know, all these overheads. I think there is a metric that measures the efficiency of charitable organizations. Mm. If you go over 90%, for example, 90% of your funds are disbursed, then you're considered a very efficient charitable organization. But it really depends on how big you are, a charitable organization. So, for example, a charity that receives $1 billion in funds would be able to achieve that kind of efficiencies, economies of scale, right? Whereas a smaller one wouldn't. But with tech, you can eliminate that or at least address that efficiency problem by giving almost 100%, passing on using technology 100% to the person needing the money.
You are absolutely right. I think that's a really good way that how technology is disrupting the traditional charities and foundations, right? But what happens, Jules, when charity like, you know, GoFundMe sites is directed towards the most viral stories? So what happens when our giving is directed by the, you know, stories that go viral? For instance, the ALS, if you remember the ALS, Ice Bucket Challenge, right? It was a surprise to me how viral that went because, again, what was the trigger? When you think about all the other charitable causes, why did this ALS story go so viral? This Ice Bucket Challenge goes so viral. And it's a little concerning if that's the way we're going to target our giving in the future, right? What is the most viral story? What is the most popular story? What about all the millions of other stories that perhaps don't get the eyeballs that it deserves?
I think at the end of the day, it's also quite democratic because when you do the Ice Bucket Challenge for ALS, you decide on whether you want to do it or not. Of course, there's a healthy dose of peer pressure for you to do it without understanding the real causes behind ALS. But comparing the new way and the old way of doing things, I think one of the disrupting areas of the new way of technology is that you take away the middleman's role in deciding on what causes are important. So you become more direct and targeted now in your causes. If you felt that ALS was important, you would give money and you would give your time and effort as well.
But the danger is research has shown that most millennials want to see their money make an immediate impact. So, for instance, you want to you would donate or give to a charitable cause that will, you know, immediately you can see Fendicio go on holiday and you'll feel so much better for donating to this cause. But what happens when it's, you know, something like famine somewhere else, a cause that will take time for you to be able to see the effects of your charitable donations? That is, I think, an important cause, but difficult to convince people because they won't be able to see it immediately. There's no instant gratification when it comes to your donations. That's a bit dangerous, I think.
I think it's not a desirable situation. But also, a lot of it depends on the virality of the whole thing, right? Whether something goes viral or not. And that also depends on the new forms of marketing, whether social media accepts famine, for example, as viral worthy.
Yeah.
You know, that has to be considered. But at the end of the day, I think these disruptive technologies challenges our notion of how we assign value to money. Because, you know, Melissa, 1 ringgit or 50 ringgit, 100 ringgit may not have the same kind of value to you and me, you and I, to a as compared to a person like Fendicio, who might view 100 ringgit as 1,000 ringgit or 5,000 ringgit, right?
It might help so much, right?
So much more to these people. And I think moving forward, technology has the ability to equalize those kind of values, or at least bring those notions of value, challenge those notions of value to needs. And I think that is a situation which I'm looking forward to, not only from a technological viewpoint, but also from the viewpoint of how the world can be helped.
Yeah, humanity as a whole, right? As a whole. Okay, we've got Keith Kam standing by now with the first news bulletin of the day on BFM 89.9. That was the Beatles there with a cover of Chuck Berry's 1956 hit Roll Over Beethoven. And the lyrics tell of a desire for rock and roll and rhythm and blues to replace classical music. If you haven't heard, Chuck Berry passed away over the weekend at the age of 90. So he, of course, was the famous rock and roll, one of the fathers of rock and roll. So there you go, influencing everyone from the Beatles to the Beach Boys. Now, I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Julian Ng here with me. It's 6:40 right now. And on Chili Sauce, an interesting survey, chilisauce.my, the news portal. A couple of weeks ago, Grab announced that they were launching their latest service, GrabShare. So when Chili Sauce heard about this service, they said they were naturally skeptical. Malaysians want to share a ride? Sure not. So the first thing is they were asking, well, are Malaysians even friendly in the first place? And they decided to run the Malaysian Friendliness Survey. That's F-R-E-N. They're taking some poetic license there to find out some answers. And they spoke to 3,500 respondents, majority from Selangor and KL, but with Penang, Sarawak and Perak as well in there. Now, what they found is really quite interesting. We're going to run through some of the findings of this survey. It turns out that Malaysians are actually very friendly. Now, only 4% will ignore you if you don't have enough money to pay your train.
Really? I can't believe that.
Okay, I'm gonna say some personal anecdotes. I completely believe this because there have been times when I'm trying to pay for my parking ticket and I don't have small change, or I find that I, you know, have no cash.
All right.
Have had on multiple occasions people giving me money with no expectation. I mean, how would I pay them back, right? So that people just often give you, okay, I'll pay for your parking ticket. And it's really a really wonderful thing to do. Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't read the whole sentence. So I thought just if you don't have enough money, people will give them to you. No, it's not that. It's for parking ticket or train ticket.
Parking or ticket,
bus.
Yeah.
I've given money before at the parking lot. Like, people are stranded without change. You know, those dastardly parking machines, sometimes it's very confusing what their intentions are. You don't know whether they accept coins or what denomination
artificial
notes.
Artificial intelligence, yeah. Jules. But have you also been in a situation where at the toll someone pays, the car in front of you pays ahead and then says...
No,
and
never.
You get waved
seriously,
through.
That yeah. happens.
I've experienced that multiple times where the car in front of me has paid my parking and then
no
I get waved through by the parking attendant, the toll attendant.
Wow.
Amazing,
that has
right?
never happened to me.
It makes my day. I have to tell you that, you know, you're stuck in traffic in the morning, you're grumpy, you're hungry, you're getting to work. When someone does such a simple gesture like that, it completely makes my day. So I have to say, if anyone's going through the toll right now, just go ahead and pay for the car behind you. You will make someone's, a stranger's day, I guarantee
but
it.
But now that is much harder with that enforced touch and go policy with many toll booths.
Exactly. This is cash only, shall we say. So not quite into the future right there. The second finding from Chili Sauce is that more Malaysian women would smile in a lift and more men would avoid eye contact. So the question was, what would you do if you walked into an elevator with people in it? The most popular answer was to smile, about 62% have said that. But the second was to avoid eye contact completely, and only 11% would say hello or good morning. I find this to be completely true. I don't know why people just can't walk in and say, hi, good morning. I
mean, yeah, it's politeness, right?
Yes, yes.
I did a little experiment when I went out walking in a park or went out running and, well, half running and half walking.
Some parts running.
Yeah, most parts walking. And every person that I pass on in the park, I would say hello or I would smile at them. And, well, this is anecdotal survey, right?
Yeah.
9 out of 10 people would not respond to me. Maybe I look like a crackpot. Maybe I look slightly insane, so they want to walk further away from me. But, you know, I never get that response. Maybe if you did that, Melissa, people would respond
no,
to you.
No, I've tried it too. Yeah. So I do that in almost any elevator I walk in. I try to say, you know, at least make eye contact
hello.
Or smile.
Yeah.
Even if it's not verbal, I'll just try to smile or make, you know, like a nod. What I found is that people just avoid eye contact and they're playing with their phones, and I know there's no reception in the lift, so why are you playing with your phone?
offline games
Yeah, so it's quite funny.
Maybe you're shy. Do you think we are very shy people?
I think it's a cultural thing, because there's an element of personal space that we want, right? We want to protect this personal space, so no, don't make even eye contact is seen to be intrusive into your personal space. I think it's a somewhat Asian cultural thing, because if you do go to the West, it's considered very rude if you don't, you know, you don't make eye contact with someone
exactly.
that you're passing. So a kind of nod or good morning or hey, how's it going is, you know, just politeness in general. I think it's something we need to work on a little bit more. Even if you're too shy to say anything, just a smile. I find this completely bizarre when it happens in my apartment building. I mean, we're technically neighbors. Smile and say good morning. I'm not a
but
stranger.
Actually, in a condominium, that whole township is in one building, so if you don't know a guy from a mile away, you wouldn't know that guy from two floors down.
True. It is, you know, kind of forced proximity, isn't it?
Exactly.
But I'm not a stranger. I have a key card, so clearly I'm a resident. Yeah.
So do you think there are also structural influences involved in whether we are friendly or not? For example, I think that we are all Malaysians are generally friendly people, but because of safety issues, because of economic challenges, that have made us outwardly more unfriendly. For example, if you see a car breaking down on the side of the road, would you step out of your car and help?
That's a very good point.
You know, you wouldn't do it because you're afraid of the safety issues.
Exactly. So let's just say if I was at a parking lot by myself and this random guy came up to me and asked for money or like
exactly.
my parking ticket, I would be quite cautious, like, because, you know, I'm constantly vigilant as a single woman in an urban area. You would think, oh, what are the dangers that are, you know, that can come
and
at you?
And that's a sad thing. I think not only would you be cautious, you would be downright unfriendly, right? You would start getting into your car and
correct.
Start defending yourself
oh,
on
really
your defensive mechanism.
So because our guards are constantly up, we often, you know, that comes at the expense of politeness and friendliness. That brings me to the next finding on this survey that says more that when you look at how KL Lights and Selangorians respond to strangers, people in KL and Selangor tend not to strike a conversation with a stranger. And I think that could come with a sense of urban living. Not, you know, you don't know where the danger is going to come from, so let's only talk to the people that you know are safe, right?
Yeah, yeah. Which is why I'm more interested to find out what the Sarawak specific results are, because I've been there. I've been to Kuching, which is their version of a city. No offense to East Malaysians, but they're extremely friendly. They're so friendly over there in Kuching.
Well, the other thing that was also quite interesting that caught my attention was the younger the respondents, the more shallow the conversations. And I thought that was a really, yeah, I thought that was a really kind of a generalization. But the question essentially was, how likely are you to remember a small talk that you've made with a stranger? And I have to say that some of the conversations I've had with, for instance, my Grab or Uber drivers have been some of the best conversations I've had in that day, because it's an insight to someone's life who's completely different from you. And it's really quite fascinating, and it gives you a sense of what's happening on the ground outside of your social circle. You know, in the office, you tend to mix with the same kind of people.
Right.
You know the same backgrounds, and the your environment is somewhat similar. But when you're talking to a complete stranger, those are the most memorable ones for me. And I have to say that, so I take offense with this article that says the younger the respondent, the more
also,
shallow the conversations.
I think that it's the gesture that is important and not really the quality of the conversation sometimes, because sometimes, a lot of times actually, small talk is a social lubricant. It's an icebreaker. You need that to start something.
What do you think about this one, Jules, that the less unfriendly Malaysians, so Malaysians are quite friendly, but they're also the most bising on Facebook, apparently, according to...
That's true.
According to chilisauce.my, to say that, you know, generally on Facebook, they tend to be quite vocal and, you know, completely disregard the rules of politeness.
Yeah, we are, essentially all of us are like part of this silent majority that only come out into the open when we're on social media. I think that's true. And I think also there is a very strong underlying dissatisfaction of our situation, economic challenges.
What a fascinating survey. I have to say, it may not be the widest spread survey with only you know, a few thousand respondents, but really quite interesting, some of the findings that makes you want to go, you know, as you are throughout your day, maybe make conversation with someone, a stranger you wouldn't normally talk to, maybe make eye contact, smile at the person going to the lift, and pay the toll for the guy behind you. You will make his day, I guarantee it. It's coming up to 6:50 now, Jules, and we've got the 7 o'clock news at the top of the hour. Keith Kum will be bringing us the headlines shortly. And after the news, Stephen Innes from Oanda in Singapore will join us online to discuss his thoughts on the G20 meeting over the weekend. Now, this is interesting because the G20 meeting with the Trump, this is the first one with the Trump administration, and conspicuously missing from that group's formal statement was the pledge to fight protectionism. So stay tuned to find out more on Market Watch. Have the world's biggest economies dropped the public endorsement of free trade? First, Aeroplane by Red Hot Chili Peppers, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.